Got the floor, yeah.
Thank you, Dan, for coming. I definitely invited myself here to give a talk. I have not prepared anything. As I said, I came here with an empty computer. So I had to think about talking about something that I have worked on a little bit and trying to make connection with molecules and stuff like this, or had explained to you this crazy idea that I have in the back of my mind for about 1.5 years to simplify modeling chemical reactions, but I will have decided against that because it's a crazy idea. And I don't know whether it's valid or not. So I'm talking to you about this problem. Metrology with interacting systems. So what I mean with that is, since I work at a place called NIST, we are interested in measurement. Are we trying to always think about what does it mean for measurement? How can we measure?
Okay, so if you don't do what's advertised on the wiki.
That is apparently, I have no idea what's on the wiki.
It is the few body physics with molecules in that
name. Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
No.
This is it. Yes.
Oh, really?
This is it?
Yes. This is just a higher level version of this.
Oh, cool.
Ultra cold in
there. Yes, that's what's done in practice.
Okay.
This is what I'm thinking about at other levels. So we think about measurement, and so I'm. Ultra-cold atoms originally started in terms of making clocks, atomic clocks, better and better. So here, that typically amounted to sort of like doing atoms, one atom at a time, or work at least measuring something with individual atoms. In practice, what you measure is a level spacing in an atom, trying to do that ever and ever better. Okay. Here, what I want to do is, can I measure with interacting atoms or interacting polar molecules or whatever, right? And for example, you can ask whether it can measure external fields in one way or the other. The other thing is, can I basically measure many body interactions? Can I measure the interaction strength between two atoms? Okay. So in metrology, what the game is how does the error of your measurement scale with atom number or system size? Okay. In this case, it's atoms or molecules, right? And so the example that I gave for atomic clocks with non-interacting atoms, the scaling goes like 1/√(n), where n is the system size. And in this case, it's just basically the number of atoms times the number of experiments that you've done, right? Not shot noise or the standard quantum limit, I guess, one of the two. So now people have been studying measurements at a higher level, and they've shown that if you could use entanglement, that if you could create an entangled state of my two-level atoms and let them then still evolve just as if they were non-interacting systems, that you can measure that level spacing between in your qubit as 1/(n). That's called the Heisenberg limit. Okay. And the tangled state that people think about is, I don't know, sometimes if it says anything to you, it's the GHZ state, I guess, or it's the state of everything down plus everything up, that state. Okay. So as an aside, I note always for myself, to create a state like that, you need to actually have an interacting system, or you need to generate that interactions in ways. Okay. So now people have also been studying things like what happens if you have an interacting system? How do things scale with that? Okay. So for example, people have shown, and I don't think I can reproduce that, I will not even try, that you can measure, for example, the scattering length for the two-body interaction strength between two particles as 1/(n^3/2, where n is the number of interacting atoms. You could still do things like measure this over and over again, but then you just get multiply that with the shot noise regular of the number of measurements. Okay. And apparently the optimal value is actually if you also use entanglement to begin with. that you create an entangled state and then let the system evolve under in some interacting Hamiltonian, it should, you should be able to do 1 over n square. Okay?
So, is it for two body interactions?
For example, yes. And for free body, they say 1 over n.
So, but let's say in the clocks, right? So in the clocks, where you just have a property of a single atom, right? Is it still the best scaling? Is 1 over n squared, or is it
no,
still
1 over n? That is 1 over n.
So then it is a two-body business. Right?
Correct. So people in the field call this linear versus nonlinear measurement, actually. Okay. So that was sort of my background. Can I sort of, if you like, interacting polar molecules, can I measure something more accurately than I did before? So I don't know what the answer of that question will be, by the way, but this is my point of view. Let's look at our problem of interacting atoms in an optical lattice in this particular way. Right? Let's look at that. And now I come to Tommaso Soymark. Yeah? How do you think about that, right?
Just to, I guess, follow up on Andre's question. So it's subtle, right? I mean, if you were trying to measure the level splitting between two levels of a single atom, no matter how you interact these atoms with other things, maybe you map this onto scattering length somehow, no matter what you do, I mean, you're still not gonna go better than 1 over n.
That's what Juha claims, yes.
Juha has a...
Javanainen has a paper on that subject.
You might be able to do something clever where it looks like it goes faster, but eventually we'll hit that other limit, I think.
This may be a little bit of a distractionist question, but it's possible, for instance, to induce rotational revivals, recurrences, where the same feature repeats itself over and over and over again, and the spacing of the features can go, you know, ad infinitum, of course, in practice, say 100 times, and the spacing of the transients is related to the value of the rotational constant. Mm-hmm. Has anybody looked actually at how accurately one can evaluate the rotational constant for an ensemble of n molecules in this way, and thereby the moment of inertia?
So I don't know the answer, but I like to think about it. Each of these molecules is a separate experiment, right? So it definitely simply scales with the square root of the number of molecules, right?
Right.
So now you need to look at these individual, what state do I get, right?
So the fact that you are actually getting repeatedly the same answer.
Sure. And at the end of the day, what you do is you measure a periodic signal,
right?
And you measure the period, and then look at how its uncertainty goes.
Exactly.
So I don't know what that time thing is. If it's sinusoidal, for example, then there will probably be no improvement. There will just be short noise. Mm-hmm. But okay, put it this way. Okay, so. What scaling do you want? Is there with the number of rotational levels that are included, right?
No.
Because that's what the argument. You need to have a set of two levels.
There are several things that one could extract from it,
uh-huh.
But one that comes to mind in the first place, is the rotational constant, or the inverse of the moment of inertia, and it's a kind of potentially, I think, a very accurate way of determining the mass.
Sure. And so I don't know the answer. Maybe we should talk offline, because a part of the discussion is about what is a system here,
right?
And what do you want it to scale with, right? Because clearly it doesn't, it simply scales like the scale of the number of molecules.
Right.
And that's the dumb answer, right? So how did I get involved? Yes, I started to look at atoms trapped in optical lattice in my case, and that's how I started to think about it. So optical lattice and atoms are mainly known for the equilibrium physics of them, right, of the ground state, and that is that there are phase transitions in that Hamiltonian. You can go from the ground state superfluid to a ground state mod. Yes? Okay. Okay. So let's talk about sort of like, let's try to think about the mod state. The mod state is actually having a fixed atom number or molecule number per site, right? Say 2. But there is almost, in the mod state, what you do is turn off basically the tunneling between individual lattice sites, right? So there's no tunneling. but you have two molecules or two atoms per side. Okay, so that you might think this might be a way to then study this nonlinear measurement or this, looking at the scaling properties. Okay? Turns out, as far as I can tell, this doesn't help you at all. First of all, I have to say Immanuel Bloch has done some experiments on this. So experiments have been done on this. What you do is you prepare these two atoms in the lattice sites, and you have basically m lattice sites, each of them doing the same thing. You do some spectroscopy on the energy levels. Or right, you find their vibrational energies, or you look at the internal energies of these two atoms. There's no nonlinear scaling in that. It's like measuring energy levels. It's like these two atoms now behave as a single atom, and that you get back to the original scaling. Right? So that doesn't help. So you need to actually do another type of experiment with a lattice. And these are called collapse and revival measurements. Because what you do is you make actually, rather than keeping yourself to the ground state, you're going to make a non-equilibrium state of these atoms or molecules in this lattice. So the prototypical thing to do is first start out with a superfluid or a Bose condensate of atoms held in that optical lattice. It's basically like every atom has the same wave function, which is the lowest Bloch band wave function, right, in a lattice. What you then do is you suddenly turn off the intensity, turn off tunneling between lattice sites, and then you have in each well, again, an independent experiment running. It's doing its thing, but it's not in equilibrium anymore. It's not in the ground state. It's evolves. Okay. This system, it turns out, has interesting scaling with the mean atom number per lattice site. And it has this actually, it's because of this actually what you generate is a very curious state. It is a superposition of atom number. It's like a laser. Laser, what you have in a laser is, in a single mode laser, you have a super, it's supposed to be in a coherent state. That's the simplest explanation of what a laser is, which is that it's a superposition of one photon, two photon, three photon, four photon, five photon, right? That's a coherent state. That's what I think of, at least, as a laser, yes? And it turns out that in the collapse and revival experiments, you make a similar-like state for atoms.
So intuitively, what's the argument for seeing the difference between the equilibrium situation, sort of not showing the interesting scaling, and
It's the superposition, because it turns out that what you measure in these experiments is basically the energy difference between having two atoms on the side and three atoms on the side. You see, I wasn't prepared very well for this.
But if you were to run, say, the same experiment on different mod states with fixed numbers, and you just did an experiment for two and then for, you know, I don't know, 15 atoms per site. Would this also work, or do you have to work with it?
I have to more carefully know from you what you measure, because it's that's the tricky part. So I don't know what you compare then. It's the fact that I can compare these energies from 0, 1, 2, 3 atoms simultaneously is what makes the scaling. It makes the evolution, if you like, nonlinear. It's not simply a sinusoidal time dependence that you'll see.
You might actually write it as a wave function.
Oh, done.
Special maple.
Yes. Oh well. You see, I got through the easy part and not through the math. Right? So I need to describe what the superfluid is to the simplest approximation. The simplest approximation is that it's a coherent state in the k equals zero quasi momentum of the lattice. Okay. A coherent state is this. I have to say this slowly, probably. Okay. So the argument is that the superfluid that you create is the following state. It is vacuum. And then this exponential operator that creates a particle in the k equals zero quasi-momentum. Right. This is a coherent state. That's the formal difference. If you Taylor series this exponential, you'll see that it's a superposition of zero atom, one atom, two atom, three atom. Right. So what is this? For a simple cubic lattice, where you then do tight binding approximation, where you say there is only a single mode in each lattice site, and it's this Gaussian, right? So then this thing is nothing more than this thing. It is the equal, it's basically this thing creates an atom at site I, and it's a linear superposition of equally likely being created at any site, right? That is a particle in the k equals zero quasi-momentum. Making sense? So I will define it difficult. Okay. So then the superfluid is like this. That is actually maybe the harder part. It's like a regular BEC. The way I normally understand a BEC is that there is a coherent state at every position in the gas. That's one way of thinking about a Bose condensate. Same for a superfluid. Okay? Now,
I'm asking too many questions, but look, I mean, in laser, right, I mean, if you have a very big, the total number of particles is not concerned. Right?
Yes.
So here, I mean, how do you deal with the consideration of particles? Is it, I mean, does this state have a definite number of?
So this state does not have a definite number of atoms.
Huh?
Correct. This state does not have a definite atom number. Just the same way. However, you can do the same math starting from a definite atom number with this state. You love to have this state. Right? That's the state that you want.
Mm-hmm.
For the math that I'm doing here, it doesn't matter the two. It's just that everything is simpler when you use coherent state. The math is not as complicated. But it's also always an interesting question. If you talk to Bill Phillips, for example, they were always discussing, can I ever see the difference between that state and that state? And most of the experiments cannot tell the difference. It has to do practically
because
to do
the number is very large.
Exactly. And so you have, you can expand this in terms of these states, and then you'll find that this is actually the most likely state if alpha is equal to the square root of n over. If you expand this in coherent state, there's one coherent state that is the dominant term, and that dominates everything. Yeah, we thought about that problem too, and I think someone wrote a paper about it. I think Andrew Daly, it was, wrote a paper about this. So is everyone happy with this, actually, that it's a coherent, that this is not an unwise thing to do for a superfluid? Right? Okay, so, and this is also relatively straightforward. So if you can substitute that in, and then you realize that this is product of I so at every lattice site, there's a coherent state. But I should have told you that in the first place, because I said that a BEC is actually a coherent state at every position. So in this case, it means it's a coherent state at every lattice site. And just doing it with this state is considerably harder to show that this is a reasonable thing to do. Is this what you're asking? So this is what I have. I have actually a superposition of atom numbers in every site. So basically what I now have is therefore, but remember that in this non-equilibrium experiment that I talked about, I turn off tunneling, and so the system can only evolve under interactions now. Basically.
I always have a problem. You distinguish between N and M.
Yeah.
The number of lattice sites.
M is the number of lattice sites.
And
N is the number of atoms.
And how do you can combine them both? Because these are in principle very different things. This alpha is hidden.
So now I'm sure that the mean atom number is roughly n over m, right? So this system now will evolve. I mean, I've turned off tunneling, and now because I have a superposition of one atom, two atom, three atom, four, they each will evolve under their own Hamiltonian. Okay. So this is what people call collapse and revival, I guess. Okay.
Why should there be an M inside the alpha? I mean, if A dagger creates a single...
I'm not, I've done this properly, of course. This should be alpha squared, should be N, right? Because I want to have the total number of atoms. Yes, should be N. Sorry, probably it's this, in this case, sorry. So yes, then this becomes basically square root of N bar, the square root of the mean number of atoms in the lattice set. So, okay, I hope I still have time. This thing will evolve, that's what I'm trying to say. So this is why my title, apparently my title was Few Body Systems, the Energy. Because the way I now imagine is that I have in each of these harmonic oscillator states, harmonic oscillators, I have three atoms of N, one atom in its ground state, has an energy of 3/2 h bar omega. I have two atoms in a harmonic oscillator, which of course has 3 h bar omega plus the interaction energy as its ground state. And I have three atoms in there with whatever, I think that is, whatever. You can imagine, it has then its own energy, right? Okay, so each of them evolves under its own phase evolution. So now the only twist now is that what do I measure? Right, this is with the measure metrology, it's always, okay, what do I measure? I'm evolving this system. So it turns out what you want to measure is the momentum distribution of this, of these atoms trapped in this lattice. You basically want to measure the number of atoms in the k equals zero quasi-momentum. You want to follow that as function of time. So this. You want to follow this as function of time. I can't measure this, of course, because that's an not an observable. This is an observable. Okay. However, if you do the math, you say a homogeneous gas and all that stuff more, you can actually show that this is proportional to that. Even though, as I said, this is not an observable, I cannot measure it directly. But if I make this assumption of homogeneous, it being a homogeneous gas, no tunneling, I can show that this is a decent approximation for that observable.
Okay, I mean.
Yes, no?
Like, if you.
I only have half an hour.
Okay, so if you have a harmonic oscillator, for example, right, and you try to find the number of computations, that is a dagger, right? So as the total number of particles is a right? So that is different. So namely, I would have expected actually a combination like that.
It is. This is combination like that. This is a dagger.
No, but you have the expectation value.
Right. So if you want to do the math, you just insert that into that. Then you get a double sum, sum ij, over a dagger I aj, right? Now you say my initial state was separable, like this. So my expectation values are, I can separate them. In a way, Aij is equal to... It's technical. So if you just do the math and say it's homogeneous and it's separable, like that, then at every site, all these things are the same. And amazingly enough, it comes out like that.
Well, is there a correction term? And if so, how does it scale? Or
it scales like 1 over n. There is a correction term and it scales like 1 over n.
So it goes as...
M, whichever. The reason is that before, when this one, that's when you look at this, when I is not equals to J, these are separable. It becomes, when I is not equal to J, And when it, and it is equal to J, it is not. It's just the mean number of atoms per lattice site. So that is the correction. This, now you're using the fact that it's homogeneous, so this is equal to that, or up to a complex conjugate. And so it's that's the answer. Oh, sorry, I should. That's why you were confused. Hi. Sorry. I can understand why you were confused. So that's what you measure. And this is, if you do this math, you will actually see that as function of time, this will oscillate. And it actually will do so with a period of 1 over the two-body interaction energy. So that's my oscillatory solution. That's the one. I want to measure that period. Okay. But the neat thing is, because this is actually this state plus the evolution under the interaction Hamiltonian is actually nonlinear. And this functional form is not sinusoidal. I can't draw this. It's periodic, but it's not sinusoidal. It's very steep. It's, I don't know. Try. Like that. So it then helps actually to measure then you have to think about, okay, how do errors propagate under this system? And then the fact that it's nonlinear will get you the extra scaling. It'll actually improve over shot noise. Okay. So this is why, so I got to the high level of, I want to do metrology with nonlinear systems, of interacting systems. And I was trying to explain to you a particular system that does that. Okay?
You have a correction term there, right? Doesn't that change your period?
Which correction period? Ah,
so it will, your NK of 0 expectation value has.
That's constant. So it offsets it by from 0. It doesn't affect the period.
So all the corrections are time independent.
Correct. So this, there is a correction that is 1 over n that's a constant.
And the higher order corrections are also constant?
So what higher order correction?
I'm trying to, I guess, intuitively understand why you only have Q2 in there, because, you know, I might also think of sort of effective three body.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sure. They are there too.
Something got lost.
They are there too.
Where are they?
It turns out that there is a technical question, that is, there's an extra, a weaker amplitude on top of it that goes like 1 over U3. This is the other thing that we did. We were looking at effective free body interactions in this problem. But
so this is essentially the Bohr frequency of the body system.
Yes.
So what kind of frequencies are these?
Kilohertz.
Mm-hmm.
People have measured up to about 20 oscillations. But the analysis is more complicated by effective free body interaction.
And so in practice, you cannot really use this system so much to gain extra precision because the number of molecules or atoms per lattice size will never be.
Yes. However, the scaling is pretty, I mean.
It's an interesting scaling data
yes.
here. But
and actually, I should say, now that all the more caveats on the caveats on the complications,
yes.
The one that I've explained to you here now, the particular implementation, actually, you don't want to know. Okay? It actually scales. N bar is the mean number of particles per lattice site. It actually, the way I've explained it sort of to you, it scales like n to the 3/4, not the promised n to the 3/2. And this actually comes back down to that we did not really measure that we could only measure this, and we couldn't, we don't have a direct measurement of that. Okay. We have a paper out. It's coming out hopefully in a week or so, where we have done some heterodyne measurements. So I have a proposal out that can then, that I would call it heterodyne detection or something like this, that can make, can measure this, and can get the, into the free half scaling. But it was just fun for us that we could look, use like the combination of internal states of atoms and Feshbach resonances to actually create a system that has the right scaling.
So, but if you switch up all interactions between the different lattice sites, does it still matter that you do it in a lattice?
You have to turn off all tunneling in a lattice site.
Okay, only tunneling is gone, but they still...
In atoms within the same site still interact.
Within the same site, but then you could also take, let's say, less than one site, and it would still work.
So now the question is how I need to prepare the right initial state in this experiment. So you could, I mean, how do you do this I need to be able to create sort of like these kind of superposition state. If you do this with a single BEC, you will not be able to measure that observable. It will not oscillate.
Because?
You do not have that non-equilibrium. How do you make that system non-equilibrium? I mean, I have normally a big BEC in a trap. That's the ground state. So what do I need to do to make it a non-equilibrium state? What am I supposed to change the trap frequency? What do I do?
Yeah, so why is it a non-equilibrium state in a single lattice site?
Because the ground state of the Motins, the Bose-Hubbard model is a superfluid, which is as if it's this state. And then I break it into individual pieces. And I've created a coherent state in every lattice site that is not the ground state of that particular lattice site. So I don't know what the equivalent is of a single well. I can do all kinds of things to it, like change the trap frequency. Maybe there's something there, right? I don't know whether that is has nonlinear scaling, but I need to, at every point, I need to ask, what do I measure? What non-equilibrium state do I repair? So now, for me, the more interesting question is if you do this with dipolar gases, right? That's it. I only have this. Yeah.
Maybe I don't want this. I think that in the end, there's a detection. But the initial state you started with is a non-detecting state.
Yes. So, yes, that is correct. So this is only approximate initial state for a superfluid. The better one to do is say is a more regular mean field. I think you call it decoupling approximation, or the Kutzwiller-Ansatz. So the improvement on this is doing something called the Kutzwiller-Ansatz, which is where you say here it is, right? This was the equivalent. Here I showed you that the state is a product of a wave function at every site. So Kutzwiller says, well, this is all right, but you need to replace this with a function of f like that. That's what Kutzwiller says. It is still separable, but it could be any function of a dagger. It should be a dagger, right? It could be any function. And then what he does is optimize the coefficient in this function f. That's Kutzwiller.
It's equivalent to a mean
field. That's equivalent to a mean field. And that typically leads to more squeezed states. Your initial state is more squeezed. Its fluctuations in atom number are smaller than for a coherent state. For a coherent state, the fluctuations are squared then? Yes. For actually, if you do decoupling, it actually is smaller than that.
Can you go through your program using the Kutzwiller
ansatz? Yes, which is actually what we have done. But it's so much more difficult to explain, I thought, that the coherence state. You get closer and closer to the coherence state if you start out with a larger and larger tunneling, or smaller and smaller interactions. Then, so you can sort of make that limit it can approach the limit of it being a coherent state.
Could you give us an example of, like, if I took atom of this species, some species that people laser cool, and I put it in a lattice, what are you going to measure that's better than anything anybody can do today, if they can use this technique? What specifically?
They could measure G, the scattering length, if you like.
The scattering length.
Hopefully.
From a time domain
measurement.
Measurement of the momentum distributions.
Correct.
Which basically means a preparation of lattice, you do your initialization, put it on equilibrium, then after a finite amount of time, then it's a destructive expansion of the gas, which would give an image from which the momentum distribution is determined. And one repeats that. And so then you get a sequence like this. And from the periodicity, you basically get the interaction.
So I correct.
So, I mean,
this is not the only way to get the scattering length.
Okay.
It's
I mean, you know, today, I mean, if somebody has a Bose gas, if they want, they could maybe expand the gas and look at the mean field expansion and pull a scattering length. Not very accurate way to get a scattering length.
Well, I'm fairly sure that the most accurate way of getting a scattering length is using Feshbach spectrum.
Feshbach spectrum.
That's what you're asking.
But I mean, what kind of, I mean,
it is a simpler way anyway, right? You don't need a BC, you don't need an optical lattice. Mm-hmm. You need just a simple thermal gas.
I mean, you think in principle you could measure scattering length to 1%?
You get the same answer.
You think you could measure a scattering length, say, to 1% this way?
Probably, yes, maybe. But not better. Better gets harder and harder, right?
But how do you measure the sign of the scattering length?
Correct, I do not know. I have to think about that right now. Off the top of my head, I don't know. But maybe I do know, because the superfluid would not exist for negative scattering.
It's dumb with that. It's got to be positive to start with.
You would also need to know, like, the average density or something.
Sure.
The error you have in that then will impact whatever you have.
Correct. But that's the yes.
If you have dipolar species, right, instead of neutral atoms, right, what would change? Because you don't have a single scattering problem anymore, right? So how do you characterize?
So I need to, I mean, it's the same question. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm comparing basically the ground state energy of having two atoms or two molecules on a side and three molecules on a side. That's, and I measure that energy difference. I mean, it's not obvious, right? Actually, what I say, because I said that it was equal to this, right? So the reason why I'm saying the energy difference is because on there is the exact evolving state, and that's the expectation value, right? So A lowers the atom number by one. So that's why I'm saying this, the overlap of three atoms with two atoms is what I measure. That's why you see that energy difference. Here it's the same. I just need to be able to calculate what the energy is for two or three dipoles. And I'm measuring that energy difference between having two atoms and three atoms. That's for me the most amazing part, actually. That, I mean, because I'm more comfortable about doing things like that with photons, I think. With atoms, it's kind of weird, comparing the energy of having two atoms and three atoms.
Because what I was thinking is just very little is known about how two molecules are going to be interacting. Right? You know, if you can do an initial calculation for atoms, and roughly predict the Feshbach
lattices. Well, I mean, the first thing I would do is this: do perturbation theory in the dipole-dipole interaction. Right? It will be the dipole moment square times the mean density is probably the first energy shift, right? On top of the zero-point energy. Does that make sense? I would try that first. Right, and so that depends on the geometry of the lattice, right? So if the lattice is isotropic, like if it's a cubic lattice, then to first order that shift is zero.
I mean, the basic question that this brings up, which is an interesting and difficult question, is what would two molecules or three molecules do if they were confined within a lattice cell, right?
Correct.
And that the molecules are different from atoms.
Correct.
And they have these long-range interactions, which are anisotropic. So that's an interesting question in and of itself, and begins to get into actually some of these chemistry things. But that's
also, I'm definitely hoping of using a dipole that doesn't react, right? And then having three of them.
Dorda, you've looked at dipoles in cells, lattice cells, or?
Yeah, we looked a little bit at two dipoles.
In a lattice cell.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, in the sense of approximating it by harmonic potential.
Yes, yes.
Maybe in the sense of what you would be measuring in analogy with what you did, is the energy shift of two or three molecules in one cycle.
Right.
As you pointed out, so it's dipole-dipole interaction, it's one range. How much you can discard the interaction with the neighboring cell.
I have no idea.
Because maybe, I mean, that kind of Hund-Spiller approximation or whatever you like, of separating the sites, maybe you can no longer do.
That's also true.
Well,
so that's
you
why
can
I don't
do
know.
With
I,
some error correction.
That's. I mean, maybe you want it, right? And so I don't know the answer to any of those questions.
I mean, it raises. I mean, part of the reason we were having this discussion in part was so we can identify some potential applications for molecules. And I mean, this is a potential application in a sense. If one does interesting time domain dynamics of molecules and lattices, there are lots of other things one can do with molecules for precision measurements. And it raises the question is, well, molecules are different from atoms. So what basically do you get different when you have a dipolar molecule than if you just have a collection of atoms? Maybe there's something fundamentally really totally different. It's not like an atom at all. So that's a question.
Let me actually pose a more quantitative question, right? When we talk about long-range interactions, right? Say if you have two atoms, you have the Van der Waals interaction, which is also long-range interaction, 1.5 to 6, right? So what makes the dipole-dipole interaction so special?
It's the length scale for a dipole-dipole is on the order of the lattice spacing, while the length scale for the Van der Waals is much smaller than the lattice spacing. Van der Waals is for people that do optical electrical physics a short range potential.
Wait. But I mean, we could define the length scale, right? I mean, it's dipole squared or what?
Something like
this.
So
mass times a dipole squared over h bar.
Right. And what is the typical
radio? It'll depend on the dipole strength, but if you begin to get up more than a few hundredths of a debye, it goes larger than the Van der Waals length. And if you begin to get up a few tenths of a debye, it's order, say, harmonic lengths in cells, lattice cells.
That's what I say. It's on the order for typical polar molecules that people are currently thinking about, it is on the order of the spacing between the lattice cells.
Plus, you have the partial wave mixing.
I mean, the confinement, yeah, I mean, the dipole, two strongly interacting dipoles in harmonic confinement begin to get pretty, well, you must have looked at that, Dorda. I mean, you know, they're really strong, very strongly interacting, right?
Yeah. I mean, when we did this, sort of used something that naively you might say is really not a good idea, following up on Andre's work of using pseudopotentials, and we sort of reduce the dipole-dipole interaction to contact interactions, but in the different pressure wave channels. And, you know, that works up to the dipole lengths, meaning being maybe a tenth of the harmonic oscillator.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you can actually make it pseudo-contact-like?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that was somewhat surprising to us that we could actually get, you know, a good idea of what's going on.
Maybe I could give a potential on that one,
But it will not be able to tell you anything about the interaction between the dipole-dipole interaction between neighboring sites. It is really a way to describe the dipole-dipole interaction of molecules on the same optical lattice site. So it has limitations, I guess.
Well, I mean, if you have the quantum pseudo-potential formulation, right, everything is will be proportional to the overlap of the density. Like if you have one side and there is another side, then basically the tail of that, if you have side A and side B, right, the tail of side A overlap with 5Ps, that would be.
Oh yeah, sure.
It's not only the.
But you're replacing basically 1 over r cubed by some sort of function that is a delta function of r and something like that, right? You replace this by that, right?
Maybe we can try it again. The delta function.
It's still on the same side.
But if you have actually, so I mean, the point is that if you don't have, if you are in a strong confinement regime, then this tail on the other side, it is never there. So then all these interaction terms will drop out. Because it is either delta function or a bunch of units of delta function, but it's still a delta function.
Yes.
So then there is a question of how to.
Sure.
Will you guys do something like that? I mean, if you have two wells nearby, no?
You would naively think, without thinking about it too much, I mean, yes, you have a delta function, but then you have two wave functions that do indeed overlap a little bit, but their overlap is exponential with distance, right?
Right.
So I don't see how you reproduce sort of the 1 over r cubed from that. Because that's a much, much more slow follow. So you'd think that you need a lot of these terms to reproduce the 1 over r cubed.
And you do, right? I mean, if you look at the dipole-dipole interaction, this is what you're saying at earlier, that you do have the coupling between the angular momentum channels. So if your dipole interaction becomes reasonably strong, and you do the two-body scattering problem, you see that you get 10, 20 different rupture waves mixed in, and that means you really need to keep 20 terms in that sum that you raised.
Yeah, I don't know exactly, because I don't remember what the sum is.
These are extraordinarily strong interactions, these dipoles, when they begin to get close together. The anisotropic coupling is enormous.
Something like that. Yes, lots of spherical harmonics involved.
It almost seems like we're starting with the hardest possible problem we can think about here, and we need to get back to some of the easier problems.
Did I say that I have one page of a crazy idea on the chemical reaction? Because chemical reaction is, I find, much harder than this.
Considerably
harder. Yes.
Because the title we put is metrology with interacting systems.
Yes.
And so I think what you are doing here is with interacting systems, but it's also metrology of interactions. So you are measuring interactions. And maybe it would be interesting to also think of something like using an interacting system to measure something else. Like if
you're
playing with molecules, use the whole interacting system to measure like a magnetic field or something.
Yes. I agree.
I should have done parameter estimation with
nonlinear systems.
Yes.
Because I mean, if your interaction depends on the magnetic field or something, so how that would change, I think that.
Yeah. No. So for us,
or maybe beyond, and so it might be a possible application or something.
So yes. You've got electric fields influence the interaction.
But there's this.
Yeah, but in
this
sense, this, not only measuring interaction in itself.
Yeah,
of course.
There is this paper out by Juha that says you cannot improve upon Schottnoise or Heisenberg on measuring a single particle observable, like the electric field coupling to an atom or gravity coupling to an atom with interacting systems. It does not help to do so.
Well, but maybe, I mean, if the field changes the scattering lengths, right, your argument
is
sure. But I'm just saying it's not as simple as, say, measuring gravity because there's a tilt in your lattice scale.
So, Andre, it turns out that you would naively think that, right, so you can map, say, the strength of your whatever magnetic field, say, onto your scattering length, like through Feshbach Kresnik, you would think, aha, you're going to get now one around to the fourth scaling. But turns out, whatever you do, this is some sort of a perturbative analysis, right? Because you're sort of, I mean, eventually this one right into the fourth will hit your 1 over n squared, and you will never be able to do better. So the coefficient turns out
again.
Yes.
It's the same.
So I'm sure what you're saying, but I know that there is, it's not as trivial as measuring a single particle.
Let's say, is there a mathematical theorem that says that, or is it that we have not found a way to beat that?
What I think is a proof is that if you want to measure a single particle observable, meaning level spacing between atoms or something in an atom, that you have this system is interacting, it does not help. That interaction doesn't help you to improve the error on the splitting.
It's a proof. It's called the Cramer's Rao bound.
Yeah. What I can understand that electronic structure levels are single particle observables. But if you have an atom in a double well like this, this spacing is also a single particle observable, right? So this could be, if you like, gravity, because you have it in a gravitational field, so you have a potential like that. And so you can think that, therefore, my interacting system could some improve upon measuring G in a scaling that is better. But the answer is, you cannot. You need to be smarter than that.
But here you are looking at one molecule or atom.
Well, I can imagine that there's a whole bunch of molecules in this double well that are interacting.
Yeah, but here you are profiting the superposition of different number of particles per site.
Yeah, but I could engineer. I can look at this. I start out with superfluid like this, and I erase all of a sudden every other barrier, right? Mm-hmm. I all of a sudden have generated a double L problem that is still superfluid within the valves, right? And now I imagine that this is done under a tilt of a gravity. Right? Then I have a non-equilibrium state in a double well. And
I mean, basically what we would like to do is to find, are there systems, are there measurements that one could make with molecules where you could do something that you can't do any other way? Are there molecules one could do uniquely?
Or just better procedure for whatever.
Do you have speculation as to why molecules might be better for this type of thing?
Not really, no. It's just, I said my title was apparently Few Body Systems. So is that a molecule, right? Or is that a timer? Does it help to have Feshbach resonances nearby that make the dimer or the trimer? Can I create the trimer and can I do something there, right? I mean, it's not necessarily that the collapse and revival is what's interesting, but if you have a few atoms in a lattice site, can I form the trimer from there, right? Would you call that something to do with interesting many few body systems? I mean, right? Because I personally have always wanted to see the experiment. Maybe it's been done already. You use these Efimov physics with three atoms in a lattice site to make the trimer, right? Make that trimer. Can I make that measurement?
Well, but I mean, if you have an Efimov state, right, it decays very rapidly, right? So.
But if you have only three atoms in a lattice site, it is stable. But I mean, I don't know what it means to decay, but I imagine a fourth particle has to come by.
No.
No. Oh, because you have a dimer.
The trimer can fall apart
in a deeply bound dimer.
Okay, so how long does that take?
So, I think there's some controversies.
Short.
But is it short compared to the harmonic oscillator spacing, basically, is the question.
Yeah, I
got the impression that it's long compared to H-bomb.
Yeah, sub-microsecond.
And ultimately, you have to compare the Bohr frequency with the decay, right? So how many oscillations are going to
absorb? That's why I was saying, I mean, the naive question thing for me is indeed everything should be comparable with the harmonic oscillator frequency. That's the energy scale of a harmonic oscillator. So it needs to live longer than that.
Let me just comment about molecules and lattices that I think going back to the 2006 or 2007 when some of Peter Zoller and some of those people started looking at these, that you know, molecules and lattices look like they were, they're going to be a very good match, and I think they will be actually, but that lots of things one can do with molecules if you can confine them in lattice cells, and one of which is simply you can protect them from destructive collisions, which has been demonstrated experimentally and also proposed in these older papers from this older time. There's going to be a lot of things that people in practice will be able to do with molecules and lattices. So that I think is an important area that we have to understand how molecules interact with themselves in these lattice systems and how we control those interactions. And there's a lot of work left to be done on that. So the interesting question is the applications, whether they're metrology or maybe simulation of some kind, dipolar superfluids, or that, you know, at some level these kind of things might be realizable, and we need to understand how molecules interact and how we control those interactions with confinement, with reduced dimensions. I mean, that's a big area. And I think a practical area. Jun Yi's trying really, really, really hard to get his KRB molecules in reduced dimensional structures and lattices where he can do things with them.
Yes, so that's...
That area is a very active, important area, I think. So no doubt about it. So coming up with exactly the right kind of experiments that can be done. Measurements, that's what we're looking for.
The other project that I was thinking about, which I haven't... I just talk to people is that it's, what if you do this at exactly at the resonance, right? Infinite scattering length, same problem again, at unitarity, yes, yeah. There you go. What do you see there? And apart from with whether this thing is stable or not, it's actually kind of trivial, the answer. It will collapse and revive, but it will do so at exactly h bar omega. It's the only energy scale in the problem, if you like. So it has to be h bar omega.
By the way,
tapping frequency of my harmonic oscillator, my lattice side that has a spacing, it can only oscillate with that frequency. Alternatively,
There's been a lot done with fermions in unitary gases, and just recently, Christoph Solomon and the people in Paris are trying to work with bosons, particularly lithium 7 bosons near the unitarity
in the
limit
lattice.
Of the bosons in lattices.
So if you do collapse and revival, then I predict if they live long enough, it oscillates with h bar omega, the trapping frequency.
So they're trying to look for universal scaling relations in unitary bosons. I mean, these kind of things are feasible. Yeah. I don't know about, those aren't lattice experiments, but they could be done in lattices.
I'm done.
So the application area is metrology, and the open question is polar molecules and molecules and how they might be used. I mean, one way of using them, of course, is the other extreme. Don't let them interact at all. Put them in where there's one molecule per lattice site, and then do measurements on that system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of system that I think, Jim, you'd like to work with. And maybe then you could look at interesting talking across the lattice sites to the long-range dipolar potential. But they're all localized on lattice sites and don't hop around.
This will mostly be the subject of what I've been talking about.
You're going to talk about that, okay.
Not for measurements, but we can brainstorm about measurements at least sort of set the stage.
So we started with the idea of identifying some application ideas. And I think... Just keep working at it, and you keep thinking about the kinds of physical systems that molecules let us do something with. Yeah.
Another system that might be interesting would be, for example, three rubidium atoms, one of which is ionized.
Sure.
So there would be charge exchange.
Ah, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Have you thought at all about that?
No. Sorry. When we think about these things too, it's like we could do all these neat things like raising every other barrier, starting to put different spin states in. That's what we've done, for example. We put in different spin state in, mix them, have them, some of the pairs interact, other ones not interacting. I sometimes think about
Hilbering.
But let me say, Johannes Dinschlag is actually looking at how an ion might modify or change three-body recombination of nearby neutral bosons. And I don't know, Jose, are you, or Dorte, have you looked at that at all, or even thought about those kind of problems?
With ions?
Yeah.
Yes, I've been thinking about it, right, and I'm not sure, like charge exchanged. So I wasn't thinking about the charge exchange, but mostly on how the two neutral atoms could interact with the charged particle.
I mean, two neutral atoms in the presence of a charged particle something's going to be different about the way they interact with each other, too.
It does. It changed because now there's the interaction is not photopholes anymore. It has important impact.
I think ions in traps are experimentally very challenging with neutrals, but a number of groups are actually working on that.
Yeah.
Including the talk we heard yesterday from Eric.
There's also this mesoscopic state that Robin Coutinho have been talking in the past, put an ion in the sea of neutral particles and start form cluster states. And the first thing that I wanted to look at is the two-body version of those cluster states.
Yes.
How to characterize them. But with charge exchange, I think that there's things that can be done too.
And actually, you can use a negative ion.
Exactly.
In principle, you could use a negative ion. One of the big problems with ions is this thing Eric alluded to yesterday in his talk, which is ion micromotion and how ion micromotion feeds into the collisions. It can cause problems and issues, but there are ways of controlling ion micromotion. But ions and neutrals are. I'm intrigued at ions and molecules, although they have extraordinarily long range one of our squared interactions. So an ion with a dipolar molecule. Nobody's talked about that very much, and I have no idea if it will be useful or not.
Paul, one of the problems about that, I was remembering this afterwards, is that unless you have a big magnetic field, right, it's still somewhat of a hard to form interaction.
That's true, right? Yes.
And if you have a big electric field, your ion doesn't want to be there.
Yes.
Right? So it's sort of. I was talking with Jordi afterwards about this, and so I don't know if their idea is somehow making an ion be in a magnetic field and an electric field in a way that you have some non-zero electric field to polarize your molecule, but yet keep your ion there.
It may not actually work.
Yeah.
What about something highly polarizable like OH, which has the lambda doublet?
So that can be. But ultimately, it's still not. I think if you look at the polarizability of the ion, I don't think it's all that different. It's not orders of magnitude different than just an atom, I think, when you write your atom. This is what I remember. And that was the problem with that.
Okay.
You can get
very low electric fields.
Yes. So basically, like generic Carnell experiment on EDMs with ions, right?
So
micro ions. They use like fields. Carried by battery, it's really small strength because of the lambda doubling.
Lambda doubling is so small that it's very easy for an electric field to weak electric field.
I don't have the numbers. You run the numbers
.
The only way to really ever do it, I think, is in this kind of trap where the E field averages to zero by the vector and not by the magnitude. Right, that way the dipole is always there.
Of course, once a dipole gets near an ion, the ion itself has a Coulomb field that begins to get fairly strong. It's an interesting question. Okay, we probably should stop. We've gone an hour, and it's about time for cookies. And we would not want to intervene with that sacred time here. So.
No.
Thank you.
Yes.